From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the program, what lessons from the Great Recession could do during this economic downturn.
No state or city can or should try to save for a pandemic. You can't do it.
The former director of the National Economic Council swings the lens around to Michigan's issues. Also today, some lawmakers question how decisions are being made on reopening the economy.
I'm not saying opening health clubs. I'm not saying opening restaurants. What I'm saying is they want to know what that decision is going to be based on so they can be prepared for when that might happen.
And what schooling will look like come fall and into the future.
I think about, are we really going to go back to a system where they sit in a classroom for 6 hours in lunchtime? Like, is that needed? I don't see that being needed at this point.
Those stories and more just ahead on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Gene Sperling, who led the National Council for Economic Advisers, is our guest later this hour. But first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer today has announced an impending reopen date for retail businesses in much of northern Michigan, including restaurants and bars. Starting Friday, those who are willing to limit their capacity to 50% can resume service. Groups will still be required to stay 6 feet apart, and servers will have to wear face coverings. Michigan is seeing fewer confirmed cases of COVID-19, but some counties have been frustrated by the pace of the reopening. Mark Hackle is county executive in southeast Michigan's Macomb County, one of the early hotspots for the outbreak. He now says he wants more information for how the Whitmer administration is tallying cases and resuming operations. Mark Hackle, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
If you were in a position to write the policy for Macomb County, what do you think is the right approach to reopening businesses and recreation?
I think giving them a progressive opportunity to safeguard themselves as well as people that are going to be, you know, customers of theirs. So whether it's a restaurant, hair salon, saying, you know, limit the number of people that can come into the hair salon, making sure that, there's only, you know, two or three people in the facility at a time. I think what you do is, you know, the very strict guidelines to try to figure out, you know, will they follow these things? Are they going to wear masks? They got PPE, they're wiping down, you know, no different than what we're seeing. I mean, it's incredible what the big three are doing right now in their facilities to, you know, try to get one shift working. And I got to believe many of these business owners, and they're saying it. Listen, we will do these things. We will take these precautions. So it's not a just, you know, let's just open everything up. I would disagree with that. I would not say everybody just go ahead and open up and, you know, it's a free-for-all, you know, go back to the way things as they once were. No, they're saying they will adhere to it. Give us a chance. But, you know, we need to know that there is going to be an opportunity to do that. You know, you got to think about it. This could go on for another month, 3 months, 6 months. Some of these businesses are going to falter because, you know, they've got to figure out, you know, their employees. Are their employees going to go seek other employment now? You know, the loans that they have on their facilities, are they going to be able to make rent or they just have to close down? They don't even know if there's a timeline because they don't know what these decisions are being based on. And so that's extremely frustrating knowing others are opening based upon some triggering mechanism. And nobody seems to know what that triggering mechanism was. And yet they can't even get an idea as to what's coming down, coming down the pipe for them.
It sounds, based on Macomb County's experience, that you're willing to go forward with the understanding that some more people absolutely will get sick and that this work was about slowing the...
Didn't the governor just do that? Didn't she just go forward knowing that some people were going to get sick? That in these companies, is there a 100% guarantee that the people in these manufacturing facilities aren't going to get sick?
No.
Is there a 100% guarantee that the people in the construction aren't going to get sick?
No.
So the governor was willing to open up some aspects of the state,
yeah,
knowing that there's this potential for that to happen. So why would that be any different than you saying that Macomb County would be willing to do that? I'm willing to do whatever the governor.
Well,
the only question I have is, what is the governor basing her decision on? I mean, what is it that allowed her to open up these other sectors and risk those people going into those buildings of catching the virus or possibly dying as a result of catching the virus? What was it that said, you know, what is it that she decided she was willing to take that risk for them? And, they accepted it. The companies here in Macomb County said, okay, good, we will take precautions. We will try to figure out how do we minimize that and we'll open. I'm okay with it. And if the governor decides she doesn't want to open up hair salons, I'm okay with it. But if she decides she wants to open it, my question is going to be, what is it going to take for you to want them to open? Because all I'm saying is I'm getting asked these questions by these businesses and I don't have the answer. And if the answer is just wait till the governor makes the decision and you'll know, then that's okay, because quite honestly, that is the answer I'm giving them. So when you, I guess you're giving an impression that I'm trying to say, we need to open these businesses here in Macomb County. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying opening health clubs. I'm not saying opening restaurants. What I'm saying is they want to know what that decision is going to be based on so they can be prepared for when that might happen.
The question I was getting to was, if we assume that the economy does reopen, if that's what the governor chooses, and as you say, you're comfortable with that, that there is a possibility for a second wave at some point, can you tell us as a county executive what happens if a second surge or a second wave happens? What will you be looking for in terms of how the community is dealing with it the second time around, and at what point we need to think about, maybe an additional round of restrictions? I mean, given that Macomb County had one of the hardest roads with this the first time around, how much?
I can imagine. I don't want to speak for Wayne or Oakland, but if the governor decides to open some of the other things up, she just opened up. She opened up manufacturing. She opened up construction. If all of a sudden we start to see a resurgence, I guess we're all going to be looking at the same data, the same numbers, and try to make a determination. Should we pull back? But again, that's going to be the governor's decision. And if she decides to do that, I'll support that. I've got no problem with it. And you're going to have the healthcare facilities that are better prepared to handle it now than they were when we first had the very first onset. We didn't have the overflow capacity facilities. They didn't have the PPEs. We didn't have the ventilators. They have all of that now. They've been working incredibly well with one another, even our emergency management folks, to figure out what do they need as far as, opening the secondary facilities like DCF, like the Novi Center. So they're much more prepared to handle a secondary wave of this if and when there is. But I think we're going to anticipate that much sooner than before. So if the governor decided, because of what she just opened, that, there are some people getting sick, there are some people that, might be dying, and that number's starting to go back up, any point in time she wants to pull back on that, I would support her for doing that. And again, not just, just Macomb County, but it's a statewide mandate. And so with that, I would agree. And I go back to my initial concern. My initial concern is I have one question. What did you base a decision on to allow them to open, putting people at risk, putting those people at risk, going back to that work environment, because you had to base it on something, the same data, numbers, and information we have, but there was some feeling you had that it was okay to do that. And I'm okay with it. I got no complaints. And if she decided she did want to open, I got no complaints. All my question is these others are waiting to know what it is that's that criteria. We knew what the first response was. We're shutting you down because we have a concern about the apex. We have a concern about the surge and, the top of the mountain. We were worried about that. It was going to be, insurmountable for hospitals. So how do we flatten that curve? We did. And everybody, was very helpful. And I don't think anybody was critical about that. I don't think anybody's critical right now about the governor not opening or opening these businesses. It's one simple question. What are we basing that decision on? What's the goal? What is the tipping point, trigger mechanism that allowed you to make that decision to move forward? That's all it is. And yeah, in doing it, I think we all know there's still a risk of somebody contracting the virus in that work environment. I don't think anybody, even the governor would say, that's just not going to happen. There is a risk associated with opening some of these facilities.
Could you talk a little bit about the county's public health responsibilities at this time?
Sure. Again, like every other health department in the entire state, they've been inundated. From day one, first few cases we had, it was very easy to do the contact tracing. We were out in the communities doing that. And, they were doing it, pretty, I guess, if you will, methodically. And there was, a lot of support or help in that regard. But then all of a sudden the influx was incredible. So it was very limited amount of contact tracing you can do. And I think that was, across the board with pretty much all of Southeast Michigan health departments. So we had to ramp up. We had to figure out how do we get more people. So as we decided to, have our workforce kind of move out of our facilities, so only the necessary ones that had to be in the offices or in the offices, we also found that some of our departments had excess availability of personnel that really weren't needed at that point in time. They weren't really essential in that regard. But we put a call out to figure out if we could use those people, maybe reassign them to the health department where they could train them to do the contact tracing. We used them for our Meals on Wheels programs and also try to figure out how do we deal with some of the other senior care issues we had in the county. So with that, our health department is now ramped up. They have 60 people in the health department. They're just specifically assigned to doing all the contact tracing. So when somebody gets this, they've been determined to be a positive test, they're contacting the person to let them know. And then trying to get as much information as they can about the contacts they have had, over the past couple of weeks. And so they feel like they're keeping up with it and they're keeping pace rather well at this point in time. And again, establishing locations for people to get tested. You know, we have not had a situation here in Macomb County where somebody who's wanted to get tested couldn't get tested. Our MacombGov.org website was one area where we're trying to get people to realize if you need any information about food resources, about locations of test sites, where you can get those, the numbers and the statistics, we get that to folks readily available on that website under our coronavirus icon. But MacombGov.org has been our go-to for people here in Macomb County for any information. And our community actions folks, reaching out into the communities for food sources for vulnerable populations, whether it's adults, seniors, people that are low income, and even the kids with our school district. So, you know, our health department and our emergency management have been incredible resources for the public here in trying to at least deal with this and possibly get ahead of you know, the problem that we're seeing out there.
I think I'm hearing you say that you're pretty confident in the county's ability to stay on top of contact tracing if a reopening goes forward.
Yeah, I do believe so. And again, you know, right now they're seeing that, you know, I mean, we're now the numbers over the past, you know, 10 days have, you know, fortunately been low. I mean, obviously we'd like to see no cases. We'd like to see no deaths. You know, the city of Detroit just recorded the day where they've had no deaths. You know, we had on May 15th, you know, only one recorded death at that point in time. So, you know, it's good to know that, you know, these numbers are decreasing. And I think that was the goal initially. And I think that's the reason why the governor has opened up some of these other sectors, you know, and I would agree with her. But I don't think anybody would, you know, once again, lay claim to opening it up means that nobody's going to be sick. You know, we can't continue to just figure out how do we, you know, obliterate the economy, waiting for no more cases and no more no more deaths, and to try to get a company to be, you know, 100% foolproof, you know, coronavirus free in you know, anticipation of opening. I don't know that that's possible. And if anybody has that suggestion as to how that can happen, I think, you know, people would probably be adopting that guideline moving forward. But again, there's always going to be a risk associated with it. People are still getting the flu. People are still getting other ailments as a result of, you know, what's going on, you know, with other, I guess, health issues. But again, this one is without question, everybody talks about novel. It's different. It's, you know, too many people have died as a result of it. So, you know, we're going to continue to monitor it. We're going to continue to work with our federal and state partners. We're going to continue to work with the governor. I don't have an argument with her. I'm not disagreeing with her. I agree with what she's doing. All I'm asking is, what is that new criteria that she's basing that decision on so I can at least pass it along? And if somebody wants to tell me, or the governor herself says, it's just a feeling, it's a hunch, you know, based upon, you know, what my my experts are telling me, then okay, because that's probably more what it is. And you can't really put a number on it. I get that.
Mark Hackle is County Executive for Macomb County. Mark, thank you for all the work that you're doing right now.
I appreciate it, April. Thank you for having me.
Stay with us on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The short-term disruptions to Michigan's K-12 education system due to the pandemic have been enormous. That's especially true for students in urban and low-income communities. What's going to happen over the long term? With us to talk about what schools should look like this fall and beyond, we turn, as we sometimes do, to Stateside's education commentator, Matinga Ragatz, a former Michigan Teacher of the Year and education consultant. Matinga, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also speaking today with Jessica Matthews. She teaches at Carmen Ainsworth High School in Flint Township. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Let's start, Matinga, with a little 10,000-foot discussion. What do you see COVID-19 presenting to us about educational equity that maybe was less obvious before?
Well, you know, this is one thing that I think as educators all over the nation we've been talking about, and how the scab has kind of been pulled back. And suddenly we have this disparity of wants and needs. In one household, the parents want less homework because the kids are already really academic and the parents can guide that. And in another household, there are no parents, or there is not enough technology, or there's not enough food. So one of the things that teachers have been able to do through these Zoom meetings is actually have a peek into the kids' lifestyles and the kids, like what's behind them. And it's just been a big eye opener.
Do you see, Matinga, different districts using this as an opportunity to rethink how they do things?
I hope so. I really hope that every district, and I cannot tell you how many principals just today are hustling, trying to figure out what September is going to look like.
For sure. Well, Jessica, let's turn to you. What has this meant for your students in Flint? What are you seeing through that window that Matinga talked about, the window into their lives?
I think it's been very interesting because it's very difficult to look at the window for kids in Flint, because some of the things that we think about that we automatically assume that every kid has, like every kid has technology, everyone has a device, everyone has, you know, Wi-Fi. They don't have those things. Not everyone does. So in my situation, there's some kids I can reach, some kids that I have to maybe text, some kids I'm literally spending hours trying to track down and find them. So it pretty much, with the experience with COVID, it's kind of, if I'm thinking about what Matinka said with the wound, it's like thinking about all the band-aids we've put on these wounds that are glaringly obvious that's wrong with education, and we have run out of band-aids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was a philanthropic effort in Detroit to get a tablet and a Wi-Fi, some sort of Wi-Fi system in the home of every child in the Detroit Public Schools Community District. Obviously, some of that may not be in place until a little bit later this summer. And the first thing I thought was great, and the second thing I thought was, what about the rest of the state? Jessica, has there been any talk about providing technology for kids in Flint?
In my district, which in Carmen Ainsworth, we have the Chromebooks that we were using day-to-day in the classroom. Kids can check that out, but they can only check out one per household.
Right. So if they're siblings, that's a shared resource at best.
Right. If you have a house of like three kids and there's one in high school, one in middle school, one in elementary, all the different schedules that are out there, and you're trying to share one device, that's still not enough.
Yeah. What is it like for you as a teacher to move instruction online? Do you feel like you're able to connect with kids in the way that you want to?
Absolutely not. Not at all. I was not trained to be an online teacher, and my students were not trained to be online students. So when the pandemic hit, it was like, okay, you have to make this transition. You have to do it now. And we did it, as teachers do, but I don't know if I'm doing it as effectively as I can due to things that are going on in the household.
The children's?
Yes. My household, I'm pretty good. Children, not so much. But I might say that I do know teachers who don't have like hotspots and good Wi-Fi, especially if you're in a rural kind of setting. And so I've talked to some of my friends who have got to drive to places and sit in parking lots and do their lessons.
Yeah, because that's the way they're going to actually have a durable connection that they can work with over time. Matinka, what role do you think schools can play, both as people are figuring out the mechanics of this and in terms of the broader challenges posed to families by COVID-19?
Well, one of the things that I hope that this pause has given school administrators permission to do is not to just have to come up with the solutions themselves. I think this is a phenomenal opportunity for when the kids come back, not to just go right into, okay, let's just normalize things as fast as possible, but instead, you know, allow the kids to unpack, you know, how it was living through this historic, you know, global crisis, right?
Yeah, students just sitting with it, yeah.
Right, so I'm thinking like students could participate in like surveys, they can do student panels, class discussions, you know, and categorize things that happened before the pandemic and how things that did not work before the pandemic, and maybe even come up with research-based ideas on what could work today. So the administrators cannot come up with all the solutions. They can't fix things come September, but within their walls, they have resources and kids who have ideas, things, kids who want to be a part of creating a better school and a better education opportunity for themselves.
Jessica, what do you think your students in Flint need from their schools as this pandemic continues?
I think we need to repackage everything. Everything needs to change, like Matinka's saying. I just don't see it being productive for students to go back to the way that it was 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. It's proven to be very archaic, and this pandemic has exposed the different oppressive cultures within education. So I think students from Flint and other communities similar to us need to just go, you know what, we got to rethink the whole setup. Like, let's do a rebirth of education.
Well, what are some of the fundamental questions on your mind as you think about that?
I think about, are we really going to go back to a system where they sit in a classroom for 6 hours in lunchtime? Like, is that needed? I don't see that being needed at this point. Are we going to make sure everyone has technology, teachers and students, to function? Do we really need to be in the building Monday through Friday? Like, there's so many questions that go through your head being an educator with this that you can't help but challenge and say, maybe it's a way of us restructuring and rebuilding and starting something anew.
I'd like to piggyback on what Jessica just said. And I know that a lot of administrators, a lot of parents are right now worrying about the fact that, you know, kids are going to be losing out on material that they did not learn. Maybe they're going to be behind. And come September, there's going to be a lot of catching up to do. And I'd like to just kind of, you know, just put a spotlight in a different direction and think about this, you know, whether the kids are behind or ahead. This is just like a damaging social construct that we've created. Mm-hmm. Basically, you know, to control how kids learn, control how, you know, how they, what they learn and at what time they learn it. And learning is really not linear. And I would love for them to look at it as, you know, learning happens all the time, whether you want it to do or not. And there's so much content that the kids are learning in their life lessons that are not really counting, we're not counting as learning. A lot of the kids that we're talking about, you know, they have to take care of their siblings, they have to cook at home, maybe even pay bills, deal with the landlord, you know, navigate, you know, public transportation. And those things somehow are not counted as learning. And in what Jessica said, that we have to rethink things, maybe we need to rethink as well what the purpose of the assessments and what the purpose of the learning and what the purpose of school is altogether.
Yeah. There are definitely countries in the world that do have a different structure for their school week and or their school days, but they may also have a different, you know, a different system of family values that might support that. I can't help but think, Jessica, that a shiver just went up the spine of every parent, every working parent, at the thought of what that might look like. Either of you, Matinga or Jessica, are there ways to structure, you know, parents' work and parents' care for their children that might also let us think differently about education?
You know, if I may answer that question real quick, you, I think, underlined something very important, that it's just a cultural and it's a way of thinking. And I think that we, like Jessica said, this paradigm shift cannot happen all at once, obviously, because this is just too big to change all at once. But definitely the idea that school does not have to be in the same time as it was before because it's no longer practical. And the idea that, you know, maybe we are stressing content that does not directly apply to the student's current or even in some instances, future lives. So if we start really thinking about learning about the stuff that's important versus the stuff that's essential. And I think in these, some of these cultures where you're talking about the parents and the community is really embracing education is because they're focusing on the essential and not only on the, you know, millions of pounds of content that the kids have to learn throughout 12 years. So definitely I would cut the amount of information the kids have to learn so that they can learn it in the context of becoming a better citizen, becoming a better human being.
Yeah. I mean, Americans, on paper at least, care a lot about social mobility and the idea that the academics that would get us all to a college education would be right there for the taking. But there's not that question about, you know, what kids might want for their future lives and what information might be useful to them. Either of you, do you worry that, you know, restructuring education might necessarily involve limiting opportunities for some kids? The reason I ask that is, at least I know in the European model, there's very early direction of, you know, do you have what it takes to continue on an academic path? If you don't, there's a really rigorous system of getting kids ready for trade schools or whatever it is that they want to, you know, they need to do with their lives. But it's just it's so different than the way that, you know, college prep is sort of this foundational bedrock to everything in American education.
Right. But it has shifted, and that bedrock has shifted. Right. And what I would like to just kind of add to that is that once we start thinking about what our society, what our communities need, the education model has to pivot according to that. And so we have seen that in the past 20 years, 25 years in the digital age, that our communities, our society, our companies, they need something differently, but schools have not been able to pivot at the right speed. And so I think what the pandemic has done is demonstrated that yes, indeed, as schools, we can pivot because we have done it and done it pretty well, I think, considering all the pieces that had to be moved in order for the kids to learn online. Did some things fall off the plates? They did. But we can see that we can pivot as a school system, so, or as an education construct, and look at what the society needs first, and then think about what our kids need. That would give us the why, like why they are learning what they're learning, rather than let's just learn a bunch of different things in the hopes that when you get out in the world, you will be able to use that for some reason.
Right. Absolutely. I think that it's really essential to think about, like Matinka said, we did it pretty fast. Like distance learning was done really quickly.
Right.
And dropping things like going, you know what? We are not going to push the SAT, ACT on you right now. We're not going to do that. That's not essential when we're thinking about your lives at this moment. We're not going to make you jump through every single hurdle that we usually do. And in making that shift and doing it so quickly and seeing that it works, I think it would be a huge injustice to be like, whoa, we all survived the pandemic, so let's go back to the old way.
Yes.
Like that's not fair, especially knowing that in a number of communities, especially like thinking of kids that go to Flint Community Schools and thinking about Detroit, thinking about kids who go to Carmen Ainsworth, which has some kids from the city of Flint. Like if you've looked at the community and you were able to make the change that quickly to help out because we've been heavily affected by COVID, and if you just flip right back, you are showing just temporary care, which I think is even more disrespectful.
Jessica, there have been many possible scenarios talked about for how in-person instruction might resume. And I just wanted to ask, I mean, everyone who's working outside the home has, I'm sure, thought about their personal safety right now. Are you comfortable with returning to the classroom eventually?
As of right now, I'm pretty comfortable where I am now. I am more terrified about the fall. There's just so many unknowns. And to just hop up and say, we're just going to go back and do face-to-face learning, it scares me. I have no problem saying that. I don't know how many kids will be in my class because technically, most of the time, I have a class of 31. I have three classes of 31 right now.
Right.
So if I go and switch with distance from distance learning to going to face-to-face, saying we have to have social distancing, that limits the number of kids in my class, that limits the contact I can have with them. I don't know how you deal with hallways. I don't know how you come in a building, how you do lunch, how do I give work back to kids, how do I help a kid. A lot of times kids and teachers come to school sick. Like it's common.
Right.
So for me, there's just so many different questions of how do I keep myself safe and how do I keep my kids safe, that in the fall for me to just go and just walk back in the classroom, it would be really tough. I have no problem saying that. We have to have a lot of discussions on what's best for everyone before we head back into the classroom.
Matinka, as we wrap this up, can you peel back the curtain a little bit? What do you see going on behind the scenes? Is this going to be an entire summer of planning and full-time work and discussion by administrators to figure out what should happen next?
Most definitely. And like Jessica hinted, there's so many different combinations that administrators are thinking about. You know, do we split the school in half so kids are coming in half a day? Are they coming in on Monday and Wednesday and the other half on Tuesday and Thursday? There are so many different combinations that are going to take place. But one of the things that we know really well is that the digital environment needs to be used and used well. And we can use it and it can support it. Because come September, teachers will go from being digital essential workers to physical essential workers. And for the sake of our kids, we will be there. And that's what the teachers do. We just, you know, we show up. And so, yeah, we are afraid, but we'll show up. And I can tell you this much. Administrators are losing sleep, trying to figure out what September is going to look like. However, we do have hints from countries that have already gone through it. and countries that are now reopening. So there's a lot of unpacking to do. There's a lot of research to do. And there's a lot we need to do to make sure our kids are protected and education continues.
Matinga Ragatz is an education consultant, a past Michigan Teacher of the Year, and Stateside's education commentator. We've also heard the voice of Jessica Matthews, a teacher at Carmen Ainsworth High School in Flint Township. She is also, by the way, Teacher of the Year this year for Region 5. That's the thumb for those of you consulting your map at home. Ladies, thank you both so much for everything you're doing.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
After the break, a big picture look at the economics of recovery. Gene Sperling, who headed the National Council of Economic Advisors for two presidents, talks about best practices from the Great Recession.
When I was, you know, sitting at the table with Barack Obama in the Roosevelt Room, and there was a real split decision on whether we should save Chrysler or not.
Can lessons learned more than a decade ago help us now? That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan was hit earlier and harder than the United States as a whole during the Great Recession. And some of the best minds have been thinking a lot about how Michigan can and should avoid the worst possible outcomes of another recession or depression in the wake of COVID-19. Gene Sperling is our guest today. He grew up in Michigan. He's the former director of the National Economic Council under Presidents Obama and Clinton. And he's the author of a new book called Economic Dignity that talks about reframing America's economic future. Gene Sperling, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me. It's like going home.
Let's talk first of all about your parameters. How do you define economic dignity for the purposes of the book?
I felt that to have a singular North Star for economic policy, it had to be defined to cover three pillars. One, do you have the capacity to care for family and actually be there, not just put food at the table, but be at the table, be at the bedtime story, be at the bedside for your elder loved ones, you know, final moments. These are the intrinsically equally valuable moments of life. And then number two, do each of us have a true first and second and third chance to pursue our potential, our purpose, and meaning? We're not just about what we eat or our housing. We're about our capacity to thrive. And third and essential is that you must be able to work and contribute with respect and without domination and humiliation. And this is as relevant today when we look at meat workers as it was with the mine workers in West Virginia, in the 1920s and 30s, which is that if your desire to provide economic dignity and security for your family forces you to have to work through abuse, violence, sexual harassment, that cannot be a definition of dignity. And so it's these three pillars that I chose to define as economic dignity, our singular North Star for economic policy, and the book seeks to define it in English. It's not a technical economic book. It's for everyone. And then try to go through all sorts of different policies and say, if you had an economic dignity goal, how would that lead you to look at things differently and do policy differently?
You've been in the room for discussions about how the country can recover from recessions. But how much of those experiences in the 1990s and during the Great Recession do you think is applicable in this moment?
Well, of course, yes and no. This crisis is like no other. But I think that some of the lessons, one of the lessons you see from, the Great Recession, which is relevant today, even though they're very different, is that you can't prevent perhaps all hardship, but you should, as a country, both economically and I think morally, and out of the sense of serving the economic dignity of everyone, do your best to keep people and small businesses whole, not letting them suffer these negative downward cycles that end up not just being a few hard months, but having lasting negative effects on their well-being, perhaps for the rest of their lives. And the thing you have to remember is that these are policy choices we make. Now, we've started to make some good ones during this crisis, but we've made a lot of bad ones, too. The good ones are we have a bigger unemployment insurance. We give you, usually it's 30, 40, 50% of your paycheck, and gig workers and many domestic workers are excluded. Now we're saying, okay, we're in this crisis. It's nobody's fault they lost their job. You know, we should make sure that people have enough to keep the lights on, to pay the bills, to provide for their family until we get through this pandemic. So I think the lesson is that you have the power to go big. You have the power to go bold. So we need to go bigger. The danger is not that we do too much. The danger is that we do too little. And what we do has to be about keeping the businesses whole, and most importantly, the workers and the families whole, who are going through this at no fault of their own, and who could come out the other side still standing, ready to get back to work, ready to rehire if we have smart enough policy. And it's heartbreaking to me that we had such a late start and that there's so many holes, particularly in the small business program, that are going to lead to so many small businesses and jobs being lost forever.
Do you think there's a reasonable debate for a universal basic income, a concept that has been around for a long time, but that Andrew Yang pushed forward in the presidential field, a set dollar amount that could cover costs like food and electricity each month?
Yes and no. I think that what we see during this crisis is that you don't need to do fully what Andrew Yang talked about, because the truth is it's just not necessary that perhaps you and I and many listeners who are working from home, who are doing well, need to get the exact same amount as the people who've lost their job. And so I think to me, what I would say is what we want is not that everybody gets the same universal check, which takes so much, you know, resources and gives it to so many people who aren't struggling. What I would be more for is the kind of insurance that everybody who needs it has an income that ensures they can keep supporting their family with economic dignity. And I think you see this now when people get the $1,200 checks, you know, about half the people say, I don't need this. Yeah. And the other half say, this is way too little. The most effective thing is when we say to those, if we can say to those 36 million people who've lost a job, hey, we're going to give you 100% of your paycheck while you're unemployed. That is bold, and it guarantees them an income that provides economic dignity, but it doesn't spend, you know, twice, three times as much on people who are working, who are doing okay, when we may desperately need that money to create new jobs, to help us, hundreds of thousands of jobs, to help us deal with this crisis, to deal with paying for universal paid sick leave, for universal health care, you know, many of the other priorities that we need to ensure economic dignity for everyone.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gene Sperling, former director of the National Economic Council and born and raised in Ann Arbor. He has a new book entitled Economic Dignity. Gene Sperling, as we mentioned, you're from Michigan but went to the University of Minnesota for undergrad. Can you talk to us about how you became interested in economics?
Oh, well, you know, I grew up in Ann Arbor and I was very, you know, I was very passionate about my parents' work. They were very focused on racial justice, economic justice. My father won several big civil rights cases and was the, you know, vice president of the ACLU. My mother was a champion for closing the achievement gap. And one of my mentors, Paul Diamond, was before the Supreme Court constantly on racial segregation cases. And so I think I thought of myself as a future civil rights lawyer, but I think I was interning for Senator Carl Levin, and I saw the way that Ronald Reagan just destroyed the entire progressive movement in 1980. And I thought a lot of that was that we did not have an economic message and an economic strategy that was showed people we could both manage the economy and that we could have a heart, that we could care about all people, and that those things weren't in conflict. I could have gone the civil rights route, but the world just worked out in a way that drove me towards economic policy. And obviously, it's worked out well, and the fight never stops, and there's so much more to do, and the world changes constantly.
Yeah. How has being from the Midwest shaped your understanding of how the economy functions?
Well, I think one thing where it was helpful was when I was, sitting at the table with Barack Obama in the Roosevelt Room, and there was a real split decision on whether we should save Chrysler or not. And I think I did have a greater sense that it wasn't about just the jobs there, but the whole supply networks there, the whole degree that if Chrysler went under, it could lead to, really a Midwest type of depression. And so I do think there are times where, having that feel, having grown up, understanding those intricacies led me to, in that case, take the right position, argue in front of President Obama with some others that we should save Chrysler. And of course, that ends up being one of the really great economic and manufacturing decisions, made by the Obama administration.
What comes to mind when you think about the way to ease the burden of recession on a state like Michigan, which has such an intense relationship with global trade?
Oh, I think there's enormous potential for our state, for our home. And I think you see a lot of that. But I'd say two things. Number one, no state or city can or should try to save for a pandemic. You can't do it. That's why we have a federal government. And this is the moment. The federal government's the only one who can borrow, who that can help get people through. States and localities are going to be probably close to $700 billion short. In the last jobs number, we saw 468,000 local education jobs lost. There'll be hundreds of thousands more if we don't take action. So the first thing we have to do is, let's not play games. States and localities are getting hit, not because they didn't plan well, but because their government, their economies had to shut down because of social distancing. So we need to help there. But I think secondly, we are not going to get all the jobs back that we've lost, and we shouldn't want to simply return to the economy we had. We have this amazing potential to build a green, more resilient infrastructure and future. And boy, is Michigan in a good shape to do that with the manufacturing power. If there was a national type of movement on electric cars, et cetera, with our amazing university systems like the University of Michigan and I'll even say it, Michigan State was hard, but I said it. And I think that we have that type of enormous capacity to be part of that, of driving that new infrastructure and innovation future. So I think with the right type of national leadership, Michigan will be even more front and center and is well poised to do so.
Change is difficult even in the best of times. What makes you feel certain that the kind of innovation and the kind of risk taking that kind of change would mean is something that Michigan or even the United States could take on in the wake of the pandemic?
Well, first I'm going to step back and just talk a little bit about how we treat each other and what this pandemic means. One of the things I have in the book is Martin Luther King's talk at the 1968 Memphis sanitation workers strike. And that speech is famous because it's when he says all labor has dignity. But the line he says before it is he says, someday our nation will come to realize that the sanitation worker is as essential as the physician for our health and well-being. Well, this is that moment. This is the moment where it has really hit people something that should have always hit them, that the person who cares for your child, who's there for your older relative, the farm worker who's providing food, these are essential and valued workers. And I think there is a national dissonance that is fortunately, I think, growing where you're saying, well, if the food worker is essential, we don't, half of them don't get health care. The home health aide that's putting their life on the line for our loved one, half of them couldn't take a day of paid sick leave for their own relatives, and they make 12 to 14 an hour, and we don't even provide them safe PPE. I mean, these are things happening now where we have the capacity to say, this is wrong, and the response is not just going to be about what we do in the crisis, but whether it's going to mean that we have a broader social compact that provides economic dignity for all. And I do believe that this has been a national teaching moment, a national revelation moment. And secondly, so that's my optimistic aspiration that we will have change and do better. And secondly, I really do believe that, unfortunately, even when many of the jobs come back, we'll still be at double-digit unemployment. There'll still be more jobs lost. And that could be a moment for, I mean, what I hope is a President Biden to say, this is the time to launch a major job mobilization, not just to put people to work, but to build something our country needs. Young people, have shown the right kind of passion for a green economic future. We know it's the right thing in terms of cost, resilience, jobs. But I think to now have this moment where we know we need to create millions of new jobs, and that they're not going to be just construction, they're going to be small businesses, they're going to be suppliers, they're going to be researchers, such a broad degree of jobs. I think this is a moment where if a president put that forward after this crisis, there would be enormous appeal. And I think a state like Michigan, again, with its manufacturing background, its universities, its ethic of hard work, I think we would be as well positioned as any state to prosper.
Gene Sperling, we should mention that a few days before we spoke, your mother, Doris Sperling, passed away. And she's very well known in Ann Arbor as the founder of the Open School Young People's Theater, the Family Learning Institute. She was, I believe, 89 years old.
That's right, yes.
She was so well known around the community. How will you remember her best?
Well, we used to say that before they created the expression, she lived by leave no child behind. She was a reformer, a firebrand, decades ahead of her time. She was one of the first people to have a full-time job that dealt with the, you know, racial achievement gap in Ann Arbor. She was the driving force behind the Open School, as you say, driving founder behind Ann Arbor Young People's Theater, and in her retirement, founded and designed and led the Family Learning Institute, which has just a remarkable record of giving individualized tutoring and a safe place for young people, with 90% of them gaining 1 to 2 grades of reading, you know, in a very short time. And so what I will remember with her is that person who didn't believe in coloring books, didn't believe in coloring in the lines, creativity, thinking outside the box, individualized learning where kids could, because it was more important that they find their passion and love for learning than that they close their books every 45 minutes for a new subject. And, you know, that's the way she was with her children. But, you know, she lived for her children and she lived for other people's children. And all I could think about is, what would my mom be doing today? You know, she wouldn't be doing this political debate or anything. She'd be out there saying, we have to make sure that all these young kids in the Ann Arbor, Ypsilanti area, who we've been fighting to get a fair deal, don't fall behind further in the pandemic because they don't have the laptops, because they're not hooked up, because they won't have after school and summer activities. She'd be very practical and she'd be making it happen, but it would be very focused on getting it done, working with people and making sure that the children that were not as fortunate as hers had a chance to not just succeed, not just pass grades, but thrive and believe in themselves. That's how we remember Doris Sperling.
Gene Sperling, thank you so much for talking with us, and we're very sorry for your family's loss.
You're so kind to give a chance to remember and honor my mother and her work that still goes on and still needs support.
Gene Sperling's new book is Economic Dignity. He is a former director of the National Economic Council under Presidents Obama and Clinton. And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.